Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. As part of Trans Awareness Week, raising awareness of the inhumane and life-threatening treatment of the trans plus community in the criminal law system. I'm joined by Erin Beth Harris, LGBTQ plus law and policy unit attorney with the Legal Aid Society, fighting for trans plus lives in the New York State prisons and New York City jails.
Many trans people experience oppression because of their gender identity in so many different aspects of life. Take a look at the 2015 Transgender Survey, which was really a landmark survey of the experience of trans people in the United States, and explains the ridiculously high employment discrimination, housing discrimination, targeting by police that leads to a disproportionate involvement with the criminal law system. It's really that these oppressions lead people into these systems. And once you're in that system, a lot of the protections for trans people that exist in many areas of public life, even though they might not be implemented, are places held accountable for those protections, really do become much weaker. That is where people are constantly misgendered, constantly not treated consistently with their gender identity, and this is a very pervasive issue in both the city jail system and also the state prison system as well.
What are some of the frequent ways that transgendered youth, really, very often, not exclusively, find themselves interacting with the policing apparatus? And if you could point to any particularly backward, biased, reactionary laws that are on the books or have been that single out transgendered people.
I think that this is a really important question on the national level because of very high numbers of anti-trans bills that are actually targeting trans youth across the country as far as their ability to access gender-affirming care, which can be very important when you're a young person exploring your gender identity and having access to doctors or providers or supports. Some of these states are trying to criminalize that type of support, as well as aspects of laws that are targeting trans youth who want to play on sports teams. And even though that kind of maybe feels trivial in the scheme of what we're talking about, of course, sports teams for so many young people are an important activity to engage in social activities with other people and other youth, to exercise, and it's such an important part of many young people's experience. And these types of bills have really proliferated recently across the states. Fortunately, not in New York, which is fortunate, but they are frequently popping up across the states, and we expect that with the new legislative sessions opening in January, there will be more of those bills to come as well.
Talk about the role of sex work in similarly victimizing and ultimately kind of dragnetting trans youth into or trans people into the criminal justice arena.
This has been a really important topic, including in New York State, where fortunately very recently we did away with the loitering for the purposes of prostitution law, which basically permitted cops and officers to target trans women for literally just existing on the street, making assumptions that because of somebody's identity that they were engaged in sex work. And of course, then all of the issues surrounding, you know, being incarcerated arise with this type of unfair profiling. The other point that I think it's important to raise in regards to sex work is that many of those things I mentioned at the beginning in regards to the types of discrimination and lack of support that trans people might have, that you might be engaged in that type of underground economy work because there are a few other options available to you. So the LGBTQ movement, very importantly, I think, is taking up this cause of we need to decriminalize sex work because it is something that our community engages in for a variety of reasons. And hopefully that will have some impact on the disproportionate number of trans people in particular that end up having to interact with the criminal law system.
Can you take us to some of those first steps when people who are transgendered actually are arrested, and what is particularly backward, biased, reactionary, and prejudicial to them in dealing and encountering the early process of the criminal justice system?
I first want to note that try to avoid the term transgendered and say transgender just because it's not a verb.
Thank you for that education. Thank you. That's very important.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Definitely want to raise that for good reason. Many of my trans clients are concerned about ever having to interact with the police because the police do tend to target them as always the perpetrator in any type of interaction. For instance, somebody calls the police because they see a person who they don't believe in the bathroom and that escalating into a situation, or the types of assaults that we see on the street if a trans person tries to engage in any type of self-defense mechanism because they are being attacked on the street, they are often the ones that the police will target, you know, even just beginning with the type of derogatory language, the misgendering, and then ultimately being, you know, arrested. There's just a real problem with cops being responsive to the LGBTQ community, such that many of us and many trans people have found other ways to provide support to one another because of the fear of the NYPD. And I think that it's very interesting to talk about the NYPD in this because they actually do have, if you look at their policies, they have some protections in there regarding making sure you use the right name, not charging people with false personation if they provide the name that they use as opposed to a dead name. Protections for where you're put in a precinct. These went into place in 2012, but unfortunately we know from later reports and investigations that that's not implemented, that it is just ignored, and really kind of highlights the issues between, you know, policy on paper and the impact on people's real lives. So that's just like kind of a small touch on that very important part of how the police target the trans community. And there's some very important work and studies by like Make the Road New York based in different communities. I believe it's Jackson Heights, where the number of trans people who are just stopped by the police for no reason is very frighteningly high.
In terms of looking at New York, right? Assume this happens all over, but there's a particular crisis that's happening now. There has rightfully been, and has been for some time, demands to close Rikers Island, but certainly an acknowledgement that it is one of the most abusive places. And then I say that saying that I happen to be a jail abolitionist, but in any event, Rikers Island as a holding pen, as a concentration camp, as a terror site for caging people, which we oppose, is a central place where people who have been arrested go. And recently, the outrage and the toll from COVID and many other things have brought to light for the public some complaints about Rikers Island Jail itself, which has led to a proposal supported by the mayor and the governor to remove women and trans people from that jail. They're certainly touting that as a wonderful thing to alleviate the overcrowding, the brutality, et cetera, and move people upstate. But you know that it's quite the contrary.
This is a, you know, really important to emphasize that I too think Rikers should be closed. There is an absolute humanitarian crisis at Rikers that needs to be addressed in a responsible manner by the state and by the city. But this plan that they've come up with, it is not responsible, it was not well thought out, and it was basically a decision without contacting any stakeholders to move everyone from Rosie's, the Rose M. Singer Center, kind of colloquially known as Rosie's, is the one dedicated women's jail on Rikers. They've decided to close that jail in a hope that it will lead to more officer availability for the other jails where are, you know, those pictures that came out recently regarding the horrible overcrowding, the disgusting conditions, and some of those other men's jails that are on Rikers Island. What was so concerning about the transfer decision was that it was made without contacting any stakeholders, and I really want to emphasize in particular that the New York City Board of Correction has a transgender, gender nonconforming, non-binary, and intersex committee that was put together a couple years ago after the terrible death of Lailene Polanco in the Rikers system to address the situation of trans and gender nonconforming people on Rikers. There's a whole committee made of formerly incarcerated people, advocates who have been working in these systems for forever to address these issues, and they were purposely not consulted on this plan, which just indicates that the safety and well-being of trans people was not driving this decision at all. And another issue with this decision, and there are many, it acted like it was going to be moving all trans people out of Rikers. Well, the fact of the matter is that many trans women are still housed in men's jails, even at Rikers, even where in a place that has a weight in the national scheme of things, a more progressive policy regarding making sure that at least some people are housed consistently with their gender identity. It is by no means perfect, but it is much farther advanced than many other systems, including New York State's prison system. So to pretend that they're taking all the trans people out of Rikers Island is just false. In fact, there will be many people who are in very unsafe conditions, and now whether they have the option of being moved into a women's jail if they are a trans woman currently in a men's jail is really called into question. The other concerning thing is that the state system is simply unsafe for trans people. You can't just take a group of people and move them into a maximum security facility without making sure that you are putting in a place appropriate training, appropriately trained support staff for members of this community. That was a major concern amongst others that we and many other advocates have with this transfer decision.
We need to put some human faces on the tragedy of people who are incarcerated and tell us some of the real horrors of what has happened to people who never should have been part of or sneered into the criminal justice system in any way.
So, of course, Miss Lailene Polanco died in solitary confinement on Rikers Island. She was ignored. They knew she had a medical condition that should have been addressed. And even though she appeared unconscious to officers checking in on her in her cell, nobody took any action. It was a gross, gross injustice what happened to Miss Polanco. We've had trans women who have been able to be housed in a women's jail at Rosie's at Rikers. And if they have any complaints filed against them, any disciplinary matters, they have been moved back to a men's facility. The trauma and the harm that that causes, the assaults that occur when trans women are housed in men's facilities, it's extremely common and it's extremely disturbing. And to use the threat of being moved from a gender-aligned housing to another as a form of discipline, as a form of punishment, is cruelly grotesque. It is unlawful, but they still do it. The stories of what happens to people after they're transferred back into male facilities, the high rates of physical and sexual assault, the misgendering, derogatory language, not being able to go into any unit because the threat to them is so high, so having to stay in the intake areas, it's sadly common for that to happen, and it's truly an outrage, and it's an outrage that needs to have change happen very quickly.
Someone assumed that the state human rights laws would cover these issues.
Many people I speak with assume that, of course, our human rights laws apply to these systems. But I actually brought a case several years ago where my client was a trans woman who had been assaulted and targeted by police, assaulted by corrections officers, and I asked the State Division of Human Rights, which implements the human rights law for the state, to intervene, and they said they did not have jurisdiction, and they fought it. They ultimately won that case. this is something that needs to be resolved through legislative action or through the state taking action through the governor's office or through the AG's office. But the state can both say we are LGBT advocates, that we are LGBT friendly, that we're this guiding light in the country for LGBTQ rights, and yet let these things happen is a disgrace, and they need to be called to account for it. While I still maintain that the state human rights law does apply to these spaces, for the time being, there is no way to keep them accountable, at least through the agencies that are created to implement the state human rights law.
You say that it's pretty constant that trans people, when they are arrested, that the gender identity assigned at birth also it continues to be a major problem.
Yes, absolutely. Particularly in the state prison system, I think it's important that people know that the majority of my trans clients, the most of whom are trans women in the state prison system, are still housed in men's prisons. Many of their requests to be moved to women's prisons have been denied. You know, there are some trans women that are housed in the women's prisons, but very few. Like, we're talking a handful, and there are many more trans women in the men's prisons in the state system. The rates of sexual assault and other types of discrimination that these people, that trans people face in that system is extremely, extremely high. And I would point everyone to a very recent report by the Sylvia Rivera Law Project called It's Still War in Here, which is a report made up of the accounts of trans people who are currently incarcerated in the system. It just came out a couple months ago, which emphasized a lot of the points that we've made on this, but it's coming directly from people who are impacted by these systems.
Let's get back to the issue of the transfer. The state is still touting that as a good way of alleviating the overcrowding, dealing with the most egregious conditions at Rikers. But to the contrary, it would continue to affect the due process and other process questions for the trans community. So elaborate on that.
So those transfers are going forward. They have started. We've been promised by various governmental actors that these issues around due process, specifically speaking about access to counsel, because many of these people are pretrial. They need to have frequent communications with counsel, and the state prison system is not designed for that. And we get one 30-minute call every 30 days, and you have to set it up like days in advance. Like, the system is just not made up for the type of frequent communication that you should have with your lawyers. We're actively monitoring what access people have once they are transferred to Bedford Hills. We are also very much trying to make sure that they've said that trans people will not be transferred to Bedford Hills against their will. But that, of course, leaves the very important question of, well, if they remain on Rikers, where are they going to be housed? Will they be in a safe environment? Will they still be housed consistently with their gender identity? Many, many open questions. How hastily this decision was made that these questions are not answered, and yet the transfers have begun. You know, if you online, you can see there have been petitions by the people at Rosie's to stop these transfers. And you'll see in those petitions the fear that this has instilled in people to be removed from their families. And this is, you know, Bedford Hills is in Westchester County, so it's relatively close in the scheme of things, but it's not accessible by public transportation. The whole ability to visit people, the rules are extremely different to get access to those spaces. Obviously, the cost of getting people out there if you want to visit your family, and to remove people, you know, during this pretrial phase, when your whole purpose is to try to avoid going to state prison, the fear it has caused in clients is just so extraordinary. We know that it is so important because there are even bills at the state level to make sure that people, even in state prison systems, remain close to their communities, remain close to their children or to any support networks that they may have. This just demonstrates, again, the state's disregard for those extremely legitimate concerns.
We're talking largely about pretrial people here. To what extent does this also inure to the nature of the bail system? How many people can't make bail, and the inequity of the bail system for poor people and too many of the people who are smeared into the jail system. It is a case of poverty and the class structure.
And I think this is where it comes back to, you know, this transfer is not the solution to the humanitarian crisis. Decarceration is the solution to the humanitarian crisis. That, of course, involves application of getting people out of the system. Why isn't the government putting their resources and time into that rather than this logistically nightmarish transfer system that has run up and is still running up so many different hurdles, when we could actually be getting people out of these spaces and back into their communities, as opposed to being sent to a maximum security state prison? It's mind-blowing when one thinks about how this has become the solution to a problem where decarceration must be the solution. I'd love to discuss a bill that will be active this coming legislative session called the Gender Identity, Respect, Dignity, and Safety Act. It has an amazing coalition of people working on this bill. State Senator Salazar and Assembly Person Rozic is the sponsors, and it is designed to make sure that people are housed consistently with their gender identity unless the person who will be incarcerated says otherwise. And this is, of course, intended to ensure that, you know, there are certain trans men, for instance, who would feel safer and prefer to be in a women's prison, and we want to make sure that they have the right to make that call. It also contains a number of other important protections regarding people having a say in who searches them, so that you can choose somebody of your gender identity to search you, because those searches in these systems are extremely invasive. Has increased protections for access to gender-affirming care, which is a very serious issue in the state prison system. And this is access both to, you know, mental health treatment, but also to gender-affirming surgeries, if that's part of one's needed health care. It requires training. It requires reporting to make sure that the corrections officials are held accountable. And it applies both to, it'll apply to the city jail, it'll apply to state prisons, and it also applies to county jails throughout the state of New York. And I think that's really, really important, because, you know, there's so much differentiation between what these facilities do, and many of these county jails have simply no protections at all for trans people. So I, in fact, had an experience where I was writing to the Rensselaer County attorney saying, you need to adopt some policies here. My client had a terrible experience in that jail. And I was told, well, we'll do something when the state says that we have to do something. And this is what the state has to do to put into place these protections for people. And we are very hopeful that we can have it passed. California very recently passed a very similar bill that is now being implemented in the California system. We know this can be done. We know this should be done. And we're very excited to have a lot of support going into this legislative session to get it done as soon as possible.
So tell our listeners what they need to do, among other things, to support the Gender Identity, Respect, Dignity, and Safety Act. What do we do about that? And what do we do to build consciousness and to stop these transfers and to move towards the decarceration?
I would urge everyone to look up, if they don't know who their assembly member and state senators are, and write in to them to say you support this bill and you recognize how important it is. We will surely, as we get closer to the session, the Legal Aid Society, where I work, and our many coalition partners on this issue will have language for you, so keep an eye out for that so we can make sure that we are putting pressure on these systems to do the right thing and protect people as much as possible in these systems. As far as the transfers, what I would urge people to do, actually, is this coming week is Trans Awareness Week, with the Trans Day of Remembrance on the 20th. There are many amazing panels and events to hear directly from directly impacted people of these transfers, members of the TGNC-NBI committee. TGNC-NBI is an acronym that stands for transgender, gender nonconforming, nonbinary, and intersex. The TGNC-NBI committee should have been consulted on these transfers and what actions that we are taking to try to stop it. There has been a petition that went out showing your support online for that against the transfers. Really important, but just also showing up for the trans community this week and learning more about what is happening to trans people in these systems, I think is such an important thing, particularly during this week of Trans Day of Remembrance.
And we will say it again, that New York should pass the Gender Identity Respect, Dignity, and Safety Act to ensure that people are presumptively housed in accordance with their gender identity unless the person opts out of such placement. So it's about self-determination as well as respect and dignity. So that's the Gender Identity Respect, Dignity, and Safety Act. And is there a national kind of presence and coalition that is similarly working on these issues?
There are. I know there are advocates at Lambda Legal. There's advocates at the ACLU, some of whom have brought lawsuits across the country. There are lawsuits that have been brought by trans people against various different correction systems for housing them incorrectly, for the abuse that they have suffered at the hands of correction officers and other incarcerated people. In fact, in one of those cases out of Georgia, the United States Department of Justice recently wrote a statement of interest making clear that people should not be housed according to their sex assigned at birth, that there has to be more that's part of that determination under the Eighth Amendment, which is the amendment that prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. There's amazing advocates in California, the Transgender Law Center, for instance, who has worked very hard to get that bill passed and implemented. So there are a number of national organizations and local organizations that are also involved in this work across the country. Many of them will also be holding events this week as we approach the Trans Day of Remembrance. I would just urge everyone to take a moment to educate themselves on these issues over this Trans Awareness Week and support us in this fight against these inhumane practices that are committed by the city and the state.
Erin Beth Harris, LGBTQ plus Law and Policy Unit Attorney with the Legal Aid Society. Thanks for educating, agitating, and organizing us to fight for trans plus lives in the prisons and jails across the country. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.